Spirit Radio Podcasts.
It's hard to believe there's only a few weeks left of the primary school term and that secondary schools finish for summer holidays next week. And on the line now to give her advice to students for embracing the last few weeks of term and looking ahead to the Leaving Cert exams, we have Midlands-based guidance counsellor Betty McLaughlin. How are you doing, Betty?
Good morning, Donal. How are you?
Not too bad. First of all, Betty, let's start with the Leaving Cert. How are plans going for that to take place safely in June?
Okay, well, firstly, most Leaving Certs actually finished up on the 14th, last Friday, so they have these few weeks, I suppose, to be self-isolating, working away from home, going over test papers, and linking in with their teachers as appropriate. So they're at home already. They would have been issued yesterday with some advice on that they will have to wear their masks during the exam unless there is a medical reason for them not to wear one. And schools have really sprung into action to prepare the many, many thousands of education centres for them to be able to sit their exams in comfort and safety. And as well as that, like they can look forward this year to, you know, a more modified papers. You know, if I take for Irish, for example, where you would have had to do the prose section and the poetry, you now have a choice which one you want to do. And they have made huge modifications just to in recognition of all the time that they lost the face-to-face teaching. And they still have the same amount of time for the exam as if they had to do the full paper. So there are, you know, they've a lot to be happy about, a lot to be optimistic about. Plus, I would say to them, you know, balance your time, go back over the old test papers, look at the mock papers or the assessments, if you did mocks, if you did assessments in school with your teachers, look at where you needed, where you lost your marks, and try and build up on that now. And really get plenty of sleep, eat, get out socially safe for your walks and your exercise, and just mind yourselves coming up to this time. And you have every reason to look forward to these exams. And again, unlike the past where the actual leave and cert everything hinged on it, that's not the case this year, because you will get the best of both, whether it's the accredited grade or the written exam, the state exam. So you have every reason. You're going to be given every chance. So give it your every shot so that you will do well.
In a worst case scenario, Betty, in relation to the virus, what happens if a student is told that they have to isolate and that they're not allowed to attend the exam?
Well, then that's why every student, whether they opted or not, as a precaution, have been given an accredited grade by their school. So in the instance of a child getting COVID and not being able to attend the exam, the accredited grade is what they will have to accept, you know?
Sure. That's what they're going to have to go for. Yeah. And as regards the students and teachers, how do you think they're doing in obviously unprecedented times, especially with the Leaving Cert examination? How are they doing in the lead up to the exams?
Well, I would say they're doing well, but there is still anxiety around the point. And now that the papers have been made easier, and now that they have the accredited grades, they fear that for those that are intending to go on to third level university or technical university or IT, they are concerned that the points might be out of reach for them because of the way the system has changed. But that's a waiting game until we see. And I also know that they have put in extra places, and Simon Harris has worked hard actually to get extra places into third level so that it would take the heat out of that issue. But I would say to them, look, not to be worried about that yet, just concentrate on the exam now. But there is certainly anxiety out there around that.
Of course. And with there is the Leaving Cert, of course, coming up. But at the end of school, especially for 6 years, it's a time when they're leaving school and there's lots of emotions happening. And lots of people have graduations from school. What's happening with these? Are they going ahead in some capacity? And if so, how?
Yes, schools have gone ahead and they have socially distanced and they had little celebrations and they awarded head girls and they made awards to students that were going. Some were virtual, some were in a huge hall where they were divided out. Because, look, that closure is very important. And really, it used to be, and for me every year seeing our students at their Leaving Cert Mass, for example, that used to be an emotional, wonderful milestone, wonderful celebration that unfortunately wasn't able to take place this year for them. So that is tough on them. But some schools have said that at some stage, when it's safe, they will bring them back and have that Mass and they will have that bit of closure. And that would be wonderful for the students, really.
Brilliant. Mullingar-based guidance counsellor and former president of the Institute of Guidance Counsellors, Betty McLaughlin. Spirit.
Ireland.
Ireland is particularly blessed to have one of the world's best gardens in the world, with Powers Court Gardens in County Wicklow being voted number 3 in the world's top 10 gardens by the National Geographic, with Château de Versailles in France taking the top spot. So this is the scale we are talking about. Now, I hope you can excuse my French accent there. I thought it was okay. But on the line to chat to us about what we can expect at Powers Court on the Powers Court Estate for May and June, we have Alex Slazenger, head gardener of Powers Court Estate and Gardens in County Wicklow. Alex, how are you keeping?
Good morning, Donal. Well, the heavens have opened here.
They have indeed. They have indeed. And I'd say it's not doing very well for your garden. But first of all, Alex, chat to us about the plans for the garden in the coming weeks. What's going to be going on? What's going to be blooming?
Yeah, so we've got loads coming on. I am actually down in the Japanese garden at the moment, trying to clear some drains. And we've got some beautiful azaleas coming out. We've got a viburnum larnus coming out. So it's just everything is blooming. This rain is fantastic. There's nothing better than this now. The garden's been crying out for this. Mm. With regards to other things, we've got a lot of bedding going in. So we've got our annuals going in. Our herbaceous perennials are starting to come off. The grass is springing into life. It's the start of the season now.
Kind of sounds a bit magical to me, just hearing on the other end of the phone. I wish it was there right now.
I don't know if you do.
Fair enough. For a garden of this scale, Alex, what's it like managing it? I'd say it's tough, but is summer a favourite season of yours to maybe showcase the garden and the work that you put into it?
It is, yeah. I suppose for gardeners, you know, summer is kind of, it's the work that we put in all year. I'd really say, you know, winter's kind of underrated. We do a lot of the sort of structural work in winter and get everything ready, create new beds, and then summer is where we can kind of show it off. So summer obviously is one of the nicest months, but it's all the preparation that goes into that and the managing. And I'm really lucky here. I've got such a great team of guys and girls that just we're all on the same page. We all want the garden to get better and better, and we want people to enjoy it. So when you have that, your work is easy.
Magic. Tell us about some of the features, Alex, with staycations and school holidays going on. What are some of the things that families might particularly enjoy?
Brilliant. Well, I am actually standing down in the Japanese garden in what we call the grotto. This is a magical place. So it's the Japanese garden was built in 1906. But the area that I'm in dates back to 1727. It's fossilized sphagnum moss, and it's meant to sort of mimic a kind of Japanese gorge. This is one of the funnest places for kids. We are actually filming a Disney movie in here tomorrow. So we have horses coming down, jumping off their horse and rescuing a princess in the grotto. So it's all very magical.
Really magical, really exciting. I hear as well you have a virtual trip in the Japanese garden. Is that correct?
We do, yeah. So we have, you can do the virtual tour. You can do audio guides. So we have audio guide little stands all the way through the garden. And basically at each point, it will tell you information. So coming from myself, tells you about the garden, the history of the garden. We also have little activities for kids. So one of them is, you know, they have to count how many stems on one of these trees or how many snakes there are on the statue. So this garden, this was my playground when I was growing up. So this is just perfect for kids, and they can just run and explore all day long.
Brilliant, brilliant. Alex Slazenger, head gardener of Powers Court Estate and Gardens in County Wicklow. Thank you so much for talking to
pleasure.
Us today.
Absolute
Cheers.
Pleasure, Donald.
And if you'd like to learn more about Powers Court Gardens, you can go to www.powerscourt.com. Spirit. Well, with restrictions easing and Ireland staycations on the horizon for this summer, when hotels and guest houses around the country reopen from June, what are some of the activities around the country that will keep children and all of the family entertained? And on the line to give us all of her top tips, we have Lisa O'Brien from kidsguide.ie. First of all, Lisa, what are some activities that have reopened and what are the ones still waiting to reopen?
Sure. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Okay, well, we're going to know, I believe in the next week or two, we'll get further information on liftings really for the remainder of June and July, which I think we're all looking forward to. The likes of cinemas at the moment, we've Northern Ireland now and Republic of Ireland are obviously two separate identities there with the openings. But Omniplex have announced that they'll be reopening the cinemas not till July the 3rd.
Okay.
So we still have a little bit of a wait there. Mm-hmm. And the Odeon company are forwarding that till July the 13th. So, unfortunately, we still have a bit of a wait for our cinemas. Now, obviously, you're going to have some more private sector cinemas. Again, the best thing to do is just to Google and see, you know, on their websites, the updates on things like that.
Sure, sure.
But regards to, the 2nd of June, isn't it? We have the hotels, thank goodness, and bed and breakfast opening up. They will just be catering for guests only.
Mm.
So we still can't go in for our Sunday roast just yet without booking a room. But then you have the likes of June the 7th, which is another great date in the diary, where we have the outdoor sports matches starting up. Unfortunately, there is still no spectators. I guess we're relying on the old television again. And then we have the likes of the gyms, the pools and leisure centres. We'll be opening up on the 7th of June as well, but that is for individual training only at that time.
Okay, so lots of things, maybe a little bit of uncertainty as regards everything these days. As to what we think will be open and what is open already, what recommendations would you have, Lisa, for children and families, maybe outdoor activities firstly?
Okay, well, I wouldn't advise outdoor today, not where we are in Galway right now.
Fair enough, it's the same for us here.
Being washed away.
Yeah.
Starting in Galway, say, you have the very famous Bridget's Garden. Now, this is a fantastic spot for gardens. They also do outdoor adventures and also like inspirational and freedom of nature-based play. They have crafts, they have activities and games. You know, as well as, say, the walking through the gardens, etc. And they also have announced this year as well the summer camps. So all that information is on the website. So that's Bridget's Garden. That is a lovely place to go on a fabulous day. Again, you need to double check what facilities will be open. I mean, they have a restaurant, but obviously the inside, you know, indoors eating may not be open. So be prepared to eat outside. Just make sure you bring your mask, you bring your hand washing, facilities as well. And we all need to do a little bit more research before we just jump in the car and head off. I think at the moment, especially for this year,
that's it. Yeah.
And then we jump over to Bray in Wicklow. They have an amazing adventure tree park for all the family. It's called Squirrels Scramble. And these guys, they have over 50 different challenges to climb, balance, slide, and crawl. There's over a dozen zip lines as well. So again, it's a different kind of outdoor activity from Bridget's Garden. And again, as we announced on Kids Guide, they are running summer camps as well this year, which is fantastic. And then we have, our good old faithfuls, the zoos. Dublin Zoo, we have Photo Wildlife Park in Cork. Again, booking it is required in advance. You must organise your day because the likes with the zoos at the moment, there is a reduced capacity. They sort of indicate give yourself a 3-hour time limit if you can. Be aware that the restaurants, again, inside are closed, but they would have a lot throughout the walks. Throughout the zoo, they would have a lot of places anyway that you can buy refreshments, etc. You know, or bring your own.
Super.
But one of the biggest ones now that I would say is the OPW throughout the Republic of Ireland. OPW have been amazing, and they've opened up now last week all their castles, the heritage sites, parks, and museums. And they have announced that admission charges are free till the end of the year.
Brilliant.
So that is something now I think we can all avail of.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not a castle you want to go to, there's parks, there's museums. You know, there's plenty for everyone. Again, there will be guidelines in place as to how many, the number of entries, you know, and you want to just check and maybe give them a courtesy call and say, look, when is your busiest time?
Super.
You know, and try and do your day around that.
Magic.
There'd be things like one-way systems, etc. So there's a lot of things that, you know, you do need to just organise your days.
Cool. Of course. Lisa, thank you so much for talking to us today. We really, really appreciate it.
No problem.
That is Lisa O'Brien from kidsguide.ie. Spirit. Whether you're buying your first ever car or swapping your current car for a newer model, when buying a second-hand car, there are important questions you must ask the garage or a private seller before making that expensive purchase. And on the line to tell us more on what questions you need to ask when buying a second-hand car, we have motor journalist Tony Conlon. Very welcome to the show, Tony.
Very much for having me. Thank you.
For someone who isn't a car expert, Tony, they might have a look at the exterior for scratches and dents and things like that and check the inside if the car looks dirty. But I'm assuming that isn't enough to check if a second-hand car isn't in good condition?
It's not really at all, Donald. The fact of the matter is, the one thing I would say is try and buy off someone reputable that you know. I know you mentioned the word there, private, so naturally you might not know some of the private people that are selling a car. The other thing, just be wary, and I'll get back to that thing about the scratches in a moment, but the first thing you must be wary of is I've never seen a bargain in my life. If I did see a bargain in a car, there was something always wrong. Mm. And all the hundreds of garages I've walked into down the years, I've never seen a bargain rail in a garage with cars hanging out and saying you'll save thousands of this. So number one, walk away from bargains because it needs a lot of research there. Scratches and that, you mentioned that sort of thing. A little scratch from a shopping trolley, I wouldn't be worried about. It's when I see a car absolutely touched up and someone says, hey, we sprayed that wing, well, what damage was done to it? So you need to check out the history as to was the car, big question. Scratches, no problem, but was the car ever crashed and how badly so?
So what are the key questions we need to ask when we're buying a used car?
Well, you want to guarantee that the car was never crashed. So now you have people, professional organisations out there that will check a car 8-year-old or less for about €25. Anything over that will be €35. Give you the full history on the car. Mm. And that takes the worry off it, because I honestly think if you went up and put a panel beater in your pocket and brought them with you, it's going to be very difficult to tell how badly crashed the car was or was a car ever crashed. So crashed is one thing. Is the mileage correct? Young people kind of get over the excitement of the lovely car and they don't check it out. You need to know the history. NCT will tell you something, but again, a professional company, maybe like Cartel, will tell you more on the mileage aspect.
And on the mileage, Tony, how important is it on a second-hand car? On average, how many miles per year would you think is standard?
Well, it's like saying, you have a fellow out there playing soccer, and it's like saying I'm 25, but in actual fact, he's 55. Mm. You know, it takes its toll on things. What's the average mileage, I reckon? Well, they say, because there's discussions going on in relation to electric cars at the moment, about 60 kilometres a day, which is about 21,000 kilometres a year. I would say about 20,000 kilometres a year is the average, yeah.
Okay. And if you've gone over all of the checks, of course there are more, and you go about test driving the car, are there any key factors to look out for?
Certainly, just one other key factor is open that glove compartment before we go to the test drive and check is there service history, or the garage may have it on the system to service the car. For example, Don, I go to your test drive now. Mm. If an automatic gearbox, for example, if the oil wasn't changed in it, maybe every 40,000 kilometres, that gearbox could cost you a lot of money. It could cost you €2,000 or €3,000 to repair. So now we're sitting in and we're going for a drive. We're happy enough it hasn't been crashed. You're hopefully happy the mileage is correct. You know now there's a history. How many owners it is. You don't want a list of owners, 6 or 7 owners. 1 or 2, I think, is absolutely perfect. So you're driving the car there and don't get overly excited about the whole thing. Take it serious. You're looking out for, you're listening out for noises. You're checking your rear view mirror. Is there any smoke there? There's a way of testing the clutch. I'm not going to be able to tell you on the radio, but that clutch needs to be checked to see if it's slipping or anything like that. You need to look at the tyres. Is there a type approval on them? And how old are they? This all depends on the car. Mm. A tyre has a life also and will fail an NCT if they're too old. Look underneath the carpets. Look at the pedals. Look for seat wear. And if it's a smoker's car, I'm afraid you're in trouble because not too many people want a smoker's car.
Spirit. Now, when you're looking to buy milk, there are so many options now, from dairy milk and goat's milk to non-dairy options such as almond milk, soy, coconut, what have you. On the line to explain to us the differences between these milk options, we have Holly White, food blogger and author of Vegan-ish. How are you doing, Holly?
Hi, good morning to you.
Great to have you on the show. First of all, could you explain to us maybe the differences between a dairy milk and non-dairy alternatives such as almond, soy and coconut, maybe with the ingredients, etc.?
Well, I suppose a traditional dairy milk, which most of us will be familiar with, would naturally come from cows. So it is a cow's milk. And then what's kind of been really fascinating, I suppose, for me as I embarked on this plant-based journey is to realize that there are other ways of producing something that's very similar in terms of consistency and also you can change flavor and also in uses. So say, for example, as non-dairy drinks go, you can use almond, soy, oat, coconut, hemp seeds, sunflower seeds. And when they are blended with water and some natural flavorings, maybe a little bit of vanilla or a pinch of Himalayan sea salt for minerals, you can get something very similar to a dairy milk, which can then be used, whether it's in cereals, breakfasts, or coffees.
Super. So like with taste and whatnot, yeah, if you add these things, they can, that's amazing. Yeah, it can get very close because personally I find sometimes that things are quite different. And might someone, change and choose a non-dairy milk? Is it due to dietary requirements or is there a personal preference for some people?
There's so many different reasons. For me personally as a baby, dairy milk just never agreed with me at all. My tummy was really distended. I couldn't digest it at all. And back then it was hard to find alternatives. And kind of, I think, as I grew up, my diet was quite traditional. So it was pretty hard to avoid, whether it was in like a cheese sandwich or pizza or, you know, maybe on top of a pasta dish, there might have been butter integrated into it. But what amazed me was once I made the decision to give up dairy, my skin cleared up. I used to always have not severe acne, but I always had breakouts around my chin and along my jawline. I always kind of would have felt a bit bloated after eating. And what amazed me was once I removed dairy from my diet, from a physical health point of view, I felt so much better. But there also is an ethical concern. You know, a lot of people would sort of look at, you know, dairy practices and they would kind of understand that, similar to humans, you know, for a cow to produce milk, they have recently given birth. And then you do question, where does that milk go? Where does the calf go? So as we then can have that milk. So there's different reasons why people kind of might make that choice. And thankfully now what's lovely is there's options for everyone. And I think like most people going into a coffee shop, you're met with options. And that's what's so lovely is I feel each to their own. Everyone should make their decisions. But I love that having chosen not to have traditional dairy, that at least it's not awkward
and
anymore.
If someone made that choice to move very, very quickly, what are the cost comparisons for the different milks?
I honestly don't find any cost comparison really. But what I will say that's slightly frustrating at this stage is typically in coffee shops, there's an extra supplement of, say, 40 or 50 cents for a non-dairy option. But I kind of feel at this stage that shouldn't really be there because I've stood in queues and every second order might be an oat milk flat white or a, you know, an almond milk latte, and then someone else might say they'll have a traditional cappuccino. So I think years ago you might have felt that it was an inconvenience and an extra order, whereas now I feel whether it's people love the creamy kind of taste of an oat milk latte or they feel better on it. Most places are kind of set up. So unfortunately there is that extra cost, but I hope in a while that might dissipate.
Holly White, food blogger and author of Vegan-ish, thank you for chatting to us today. And you can check out our website, www.holly.ie.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.